I want to talk about what's God doing with all of us. Why did He create a Feast of Tabernacles? What is the reason He commanded us to observe it? What's the purpose and what's going on in the Bible? I talked, said just a minute ago about what's God doing with His people. Turn the news on 5 minutes and you'll be asking yourself that question. I answered an email this morning and I said, I remember in the 60s the race riots, my dad going to work in Milwaukee and people rioting, were throwing bricks and stuff down from the overpasses, people driving on the freeway through windshields and trying to hurt people, and riots going on. And yeah, it was a lot worse in places like California and stuff, but even in Milwaukee, there were riots going on. I remember watching the news, worried about my dad. Is he going to get home from work okay? You know, you're a kid growing up and you're thinking about things. That doesn't compare anything with what's going on in the world today. And I'm not talking today about the riots and everything else. It's just that this is crazy. This is nonsense. When Kenosha was burning, a little town. I used to work in Kenosha. We'd go to Kenosha a lot. I knew where some of those buildings were. And if it happens in a little town like that, when you talk about big towns, Atlanta and Seattle and all of that garbage going on, it's nonsense. It's craziness. But that's not what God's plan is. That's Satan stirring things up and getting people divided. You know, it's no wonder that the world is divided. If He can take people that are supposed to be worshiping Him, or if Satan can take people that are supposed to be worshiping God and get them divided at each other. You ever think about it, what it looks like to the world? If somebody from United is talking to somebody from Living, which didn't those groups, weren't they the same? They all came out of Worldwide at the same time. But anyhow, and they're saying why they can't meet with each other, because you guys do this and you don't do that. And to somebody that's a Sunday keeper, it's got to be even worse than for me looking at why don't the Presbyterians get along with the Methodists. They're all the same, ain't they? But when it comes down to Sabbath-keeping, holy-day-keeping groups, and you step back and you see how much Satan has divided us, and yet there's a million different reasons and ways how He does it, but the bottom line is He does it, and we fall for it. Is it no wonder that He divides people out in the world? And He's got them hating just simply because of who you are? You're hated, and so your life is at risk, and they want to come after you? But that's not what we're supposed to be doing. And we're supposed to take a break from that. We're supposed to get away from that. We're supposed to get together. And I want to look at John chapter 1, verse 14. This is one of the themes about tabernacling. It says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And He beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." Shekinu. It's Strong's 4636. That word, He became flesh and He dwelt. What does it mean when He was dwelling among us? Oh yeah, I know He accomplished a lot of things. But even what words did God choose to have the Bible recorded and written in? It means to occupy as a mansion, specifically to reside as God did in the tabernacle of old, a symbol of protection and communion. So He came to occupy, just like God came to occupy, or He did, because He was the Jehovah of the Old Testament. Christ came down and was born as a human being to tabernacle with us. It was more than just little baby born in a manger, and then he grew up and he died for our sins. He wanted to be with us. And I talked a lot about that's the purpose of the tabernacle itself. What happens after the 1,000 years? In Revelation 21, verse 3, it says, "And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God." So after the 1,000 years, after we've all, after Satan's destroyed, thrown in the lake of fire, and after all of that is accomplished, we all know the scenario, we all know the sequence. Then our Father himself comes down, moves his throne from heaven to the earth, talks about, you know, the great city, the New Jerusalem, all of that. But the purpose is so that he can come down and tabernacle with us. Now, I don't know about you, but I've moved from one part of the country to the other, and there has to be a good reason why you do it. You just don't say, most people anyhow, just don't say, I'm sick of my surroundings, and I'm going to just pick everything up and leave everybody and everything I know, and I'm going to go some far away distant land. That's nothing compared to what God's going to do. He's moving his throne here so that he can be with us. It's a pretty important theme. And ultimately, that's one of the things that we're supposed to be looking forward to. You know, he gets us out of the world. You leave your problems behind. I know sometimes they follow you. Sometimes, no matter how hard you try, especially when we got these dumb things that we carry around all the time, they just, you know, emails and texts and phone calls, and it's hard to get away from it. But that's really the goal. That's spend it with his children and spend it with him. And his tabernacles, let me ask you, is tabernacles only for those that understand and keep the holy days? Let me tell you a little story. Most of you know him. My brother-in-law, Mary's sister's husband, Tom, died about a year and a half ago. Back in the early 90s, Tom told me, he called me up and he says, "We'd like to go down to Florida with you guys. You got some really good rates." Now, we're not there for any of the meetings. We're not interested in that. But we can spend some time with you. Are you going to have time where we could get together? And then we'll just enjoy ourselves. So Tom started coming to the Feast of Tabernacles, and Tom wasn't going to church anywhere. Tom hadn't gone to church anywhere since him and Linda were dating. But Tom started, I think the first meeting he ever attended was the Fun Show. And he taped it, he videotaped it, and, you know, he had a good time. And I don't know if it was that year he came to services one time, eventually he came to one service, and then he skipped a couple, two or three, and then he started coming to another. And after just a few years, wasn't very long, one year Tommy came, and he came to every service that there was. In fact, I think, if I remember right, that was 2000 or 2001, somewhere back in there. Cumberland Falls. So maybe 2003, I don't know. No, 2000. But anyhow, it doesn't matter the year. And here we got a man that didn't understand. When him and Linda got married, he couldn't read. How's he going to read the Bible? And when his kids were going to school, they would bring home their homework and Daddy would help them. That's how Tommy learned to read. With his kids, when they were learning to read. And then he started out with tapes, music, Man, Tommy would drive us crazy. We'd go over to his house to see him. We'd go up to Wisconsin or something, and all he'd do is he'd be playing all of this praise music and different church music and different things going on. He found a relationship. He got converted. And the last thing he wanted for his kids, he got them all together before he was dying. The thing he wanted the most was to get his kids to understand the relationship that he had, and he wanted them to have it. Because none of his kids go to church. None of his kids do anything. And he realized what it was like not having that relationship and what it meant to him, and he wanted to pass it on to his children. He wanted his children to tabernacle with God. Now, in the book of Genesis, it's about the beginning of the creation, and it's a chronological story about mankind from Adam onward. You know, we all know the stories. We've been through them. We teach the kids when I was a kid on the little felt board in Sabbath school, they taught us the stories. But really, what's going on is the Bible is a love story. It's a love story that follows between God, Adam, and Adam's descendants. The book of Exodus continues this chronological outline. There's suffering in Egypt. Moses is saved as a child from death, exiled from Egypt, meets God, leads Israel out of slavery. In chapter 19, it's Pentecost, and Israel is at the base of the mountain. And every year at Pentecost, we read about these things. Nothing wrong with going through all that. And God speaks and gives the law and the covenants. Then, in Exodus 24, verse 3, it says, "So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, 'All the words which the Lord has said, we will do.'" So they were afraid. They said, "Oh, Moses, you go talk to him and then tell us what he says." And that's what happened. So Moses says, "Everything God says, we agree to. We want in on the deal." So then, after that, Moses goes up and he gets the two tablets of stone, the Ten Commandments. In verse 15, it says that Moses went up onto the mountain and the cloud covered the mountain. Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day he called Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. So Moses went into the middle of the cloud and went up into the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Now, chronologically, we know what's going on. Everybody knows the story. So what's this got to do with tabernacling? Well, here's Moses up on the mountain with God. He's getting the law. Moses is learning about the covenant that God's going to make with his people. But after this 40 days, he tells us he was up there for 40 days. The chronological order is broken here. It just doesn't come on, you know, continue on and say, "Well, God tells Moses, get down from here. Those people are doing evil. I'm going to destroy them all. I'm going to kill them all, and I'm going to start over with you." It doesn't do that. It skips. People have made a golden calf. They've done a lot of pagan, idolatrous things. But we don't read about that in Exodus 24. We got to wait all the way until chapter 32 to find out what happened there. He continues on and he says something else. Exodus chapter 25, verse 1. It says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering.'" Wait a minute. It skips, "I'm going to kill them all. I'm going to destroy every one of them. They're evil. And in the Bible it tells us, here he switches gears here, and he's telling us, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel, lest they bring me an offering from everyone who gives it willingly with his heart. You shall take my offering, and this is the offering which you shall take from them: gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen and goat's hair, ram skins dyed red, badger skins, and acacia wood, oil for the light, and spices for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate, and on them make me a sanctuary. And then it tells us why, that I may dwell among them. You realize this came later. This came after I'm going to kill them all. But we read it before. Verse 9, according to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it. So here he's giving them instructions to build him a tabernacle so that he can dwell in his, right in the middle of his people. It's God's desire. You know, he tells us that if we search for him with all our might and all our soul, we'll find him. But it's his desire to be with us. That's why it's important. That's why three times a year he tells us, get away from the world, leave all of that crap behind you, and spend some time with me. Oh, and so you don't forget it, every week, every seventh day, we've got an appointment. We've got a date night. It'll take too long. I'm not going to go into the stories about, I'll touch on it briefly, about for years and years and years, I was guilty. I'd look and see, what time is it on a Saturday? Or starting with Friday. Know what time sundown is on Friday night? Oh, man, I got so much to get taken care of. I gotta hurry up and get my stuff done. That's the priority. Because come Sabbath, we can't do nothing. And then on Saturday, and we always meet in the afternoons, different groups do different things. But then it was like, well, sundown is, I don't know what time it is here, just say 7 o'clock. It's only 6:30. We got another half hour. And then it hit me one day. I understood. I remembered what date night was with Mary when we were young and when we were dating. I was supposed to be home at 10 or 11, whatever time it was. I looked forward. She'd come by and because she was an older woman, she'd come by in her car and pick me up, and we'd go to church Sabbath morning. Saturday was, every Sabbath was a date day for us. And then we'd have the whole day, we'd spend it together. And if I was supposed to be home at 10, you know, when it got down to like 9 o'clock, it was like, oh, man, this sucks. 9:30, it was even worse. 10 o'clock, we were on our way. You know, we'd pull up the driveway at 10:15 or something. But then it was awful because it was almost over. And that's really what God wants it with us. Instead of saying, oh, wow, I can't wait for it to be over. If that's how we feel, there's something wrong with the relationship. You know, we can understand that with couples. If they can't wait for one of them to go to work or can't wait for one of them to leave, well, why don't you go with the boys and go have some fun? Or why don't you go shopping with the girls? If they can't wait to get rid of each other, something's really wrong in that marriage. It's not going to last. It's crisis time. If something is like that with our relationship where we can't wait for it to get over with God, something's really seriously wrong in that relationship. It's not some mystical, far-off thing. He wants something for real that you can feel between Him and you. And nobody can come and destroy that. Because they're going to try. It's crisis time. It's, you know, it's 911 time for prayers. But build the sanctuary so that He can live with us. I'm going to go on. Oh, what happened to the golden calf? Well, we know what goes on. But verse 10, Exodus 25, verse 10, let me read from there. And they shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width. This is very peculiar. I'm going to read what He commands us, and then I'm going to ask you some questions about it, because it's very strange. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width, 1.5 cubits its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold, inside and out. You shall overlay it and shall make on it a molding of gold all around. And you shall cast 4 rings of gold for it and put them in the 4 corners. 2 rings shall be on one side and 2 rings on the other side. And you shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put the poles and the rings on the sides of the ark that the ark may be carried by them. The poles shall be in the rings of the ark and shall be taken from it, and you shall put into the ark the testimony which I give you, and you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length and 1.5 cubits its width. Now, I'm not going to bore you to death, but several years ago I did a whole series on the tabernacle. And how the closer you got to the Holy of Holies, the more precious the materials were, and the holier it was. And then as you worked your way, you went from gold to silver to bronze. But he tells them, gather up all of this material, and then he starts with the Ark of the Covenant and starts telling them how they should make it. Verse 18. You shall make 2 cherubim of gold of hammered work, and you shall make them at the 2 ends on the mercy seat. Make one cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherubim at the 2 ends of one piece with the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above and covering the mercy seat with their wings. And they shall face one another. The faces of the cherubim shall be towards the mercy seat. So it goes into great detail of how things are supposed to be made. The materials. And you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I will meet with you. And there I shall meet with you. Verse 22, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat. So this is where God is actually going to speak with the high priest. Which I will give you in commandment to the children of Israel. Now I said this was kind of strange. Who here, now I know some of you, who here has done anything with carpentry work? Okay. Who here has had a house built? Even if you didn't build it yourself, you hired a builder or somebody to build the house. Okay. Did you ever say, I got this fantastic living room couch and my favorite reclining chair, and I'm going to put that smack right over here. I'm going to lay out the dimensions where the house might be. But right there in the living room, that's where I'm going to start. And I'm going to put my house, my couch there, and my favorite chair there, or maybe my big screen TV or whatever it is. and then I'm going to build the house around it. That's not how we think. That's not how we do things. So to me, that triggered something. What's God doing here? What he did is he started with this Ark of the Covenant, and he told them exactly how to make it, how to build it, described the cherubims, described the mercy seat, told them what was going to go inside of it, and then he goes on and he tells them how to do the rest of the tabernacle. So let me ask you a question. What do you think is the most important part? And this is really easy. It's not a trick question. It's really easy. What do you think the most important part of the tabernacle is? It's the Holy of Holies. Why? First, it's all gold there. It's acacia wood for the ark, yes, but it's gold covered. Everything's covered in gold. And then you got actually the two tablets. You got Aaron's rod, you got the manna, and you've got a Torah scroll. But that's where God, above the mercy seat, and he calls it a mercy seat. You know, to be honest, sometimes when I was growing up and they'd tell me about God, mercy seat wasn't really mentioned. It was like, sit down, shut up, be quiet, we're going to church. When we get home, get something to eat, and then we're taking a nap. Oh, no television, no radio. What am I supposed to do? Read your Sabbath quarterly. Or your Bible. The Bible would be even better, but, you know, read the little quarterly. A mercy seat? That, if I heard that, that was just like a passing thing. God created the mercy seat that he dwells above so that he can tabernacle with us. It's not only date night, it's date week. Yes. Go on the glass bottom boat, which was a fraud. You couldn't see under the out the glass bottom. We should have got a discount. Go to Zoo World, go bowling, go to arcades, go have a great time. But he wants to be with us. One of the most important things, and unfortunately for me, I didn't get it. I'm just saying, oh, they did everything wrong. Well, no, I'm sure there's two men in my life that have been spiritual giants. Three that I've known. One was my grandfather. One was Mary's dad. And one was Charlie Kimbrough. Two of the three, my grandfather and Mary's dad, died thinking, oh man, that lake of fire is there waiting for him. How are we ever going to get through to him? Her dad had given up trying. Her mother didn't give up. She, well, go off into all of that. She'd ask me, what was I supposed to gain even if I get the whole world if I lose my soul? You know, she had one verse she quoted over and over and over to me. But the most important thing you can do with your children, because kids are supposed to be dear to our hearts. I mean, if you've got kids, you love them. And the most important thing you want to do is try and give them the ability, the knowledge on how to have a relationship with God. And that comes some serious time, and it comes some fun time, and it comes by leading as an example. Because one thing kids can do is they can spot a hypocrite a mile away. You can't cuss at them and beat them on the way to church and then tell them to put their church smile on and walk in the door. It doesn't work like that. Unfortunately, there was a family in our congregation when their kids got older. I asked them when they're on their own. I said, well, why don't you come to church? And they said, because any place that my parents would be welcome, I won't step foot in it. And they were serious. And their kids still don't keep anything as far as Sabbath, holy days, or anything. That's sad. So we want to set it, we want to transfer that. Like I was explaining, Tom wanted nothing more than his kids. I talked the first time about my mother. She says, when you're laying there and you're in a, you can't open your eyes, you can't move, you can't even breathe, you realize nothing matters but God and those that you love. That's the bottom line. That's what matters. And really, it is in that order, God and those that you love, because if you really love those, you want God to be first in their life, too. I want Mary to have a better relationship with Jesus than she does with me. Because if she does, oh, I'm the luckiest man in the world. All right. So he starts with the furniture, basically, and he builds the tabernacle around it. But the only reason for the furniture is first in his living room, for him to sit on the mercy seat and to dwell with his people, and then for the rest of it, starting with the priests and then out into the people, into the courtyards, for them to be able to come and dwell with him and spend time with him. So it's not some faraway mystical thing where people think you're crazy. Who are you talking to? They walk up and you're praying. Yeah, who are you talking to? You really think somebody's listening there? It's not like Satan Claus, where kids are going up and begging for something for Xmas. It's real. That's how he works with us. What's in our heart? What's in the midst of us? And what's on the inside? And then you work your way out what's on the outside. Didn't Jesus say, condemn the scribes and the Pharisees for that very thing? Oh, they looked holy. They had their robes and they looked all official and they had their positions. But he said, inside they were dead man's bones. Now, for those that don't know, that's the highest type of defilement that you can get. To be ritually impure. First, you're unclean for a whole week if you've come in contact with the dead man's bones. But it requires something else. It requires something that was very precious. Does anybody else know what it requires? It's in Numbers, it tells you. It requires the ashes from the red heifer. There's only been 9 of them throughout all history. There's a prophecy that there'll be a 10th, and then that's when they'll rebuild the temple and stuff. But when you're talking, if you want to give somebody a slam, a dig, you tell them that inside they're like whitewashed sepulchers, like the tombs for the dead bodies. The highest type of ritual defilement, that means you are incapable and disqualified from performing the duties that you're supposed to be performing so that people can worship. So, it was beautiful. That's just a rendering of what that might have been like. But you ever wonder about all of the intricacy and everything? We got the Holy of Holies on the far left end there, but you realize that only a select few people ever even... It's not like you go to church or wherever you meet every Sabbath and you go inside. There's a priest there at the altar of incense. He drew lots every day to see whose lot that fell on, that even went inside. The only one that went into Holy of Holies was the high priest one day out of the year, once a year. Very few of the priests ever even got. There were so many things for the priest to do, the instruments, the sacrifices, the altar outside, getting the firewood together. You know, I mean, there was a lot of jobs to do, but hardly anybody ever saw the inside of that building. Except her father, or Yeshua, actually, not her father, He didn't go inside the tabernacle or the temple. It was Yeshua. That's why the second temple, the Holy Holies, was empty. There was nothing in there. There was no Ark of the Covenant. There was no Shekinah glory. There was no presence of God. Why? He's walking around on the face of the earth and he's teaching people. Matthew chapter 23, verse 25. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they're full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and the dish, and the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanliness. Even so you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Inside should be beautiful in each one of us. We worry about the outside. God worries about the inside. That's what, and guess what? This isn't a hammer on everybody. And nobody has made that. Okay? We're all flawed and we all are a bunch of misfits. Okay? But the good news is that He desires a relationship so much with us that He'll cleanse that inside for us so that our outsides can be okay. Not to the world, because the world is going to look at us and say, but those that are truly His children are going to know more of what's on the inside. That's why I really am disappointed and concerned at the same time for Tiffany's dad, JW. He is my friend. Why is he my friend? Because I got to know him by keeping several Feast of Tabernacles with him, by talking to him on the telephone, by doing things with him. And when you find somebody that's pure on the inside, is he perfect? Heck no! Ask Tiffany. She knows far more than you, but she won't tell you because she loves her dad. But he ain't perfect. But because he desires a relationship with our Father, he's cleansed the inside so that the outside can be pure. He is a great man. And there's a lot of other men and women that aren't here today that are great because of our Father. Because they took the time to tabernacle with our Savior. And to help others out of love. Not to pat themselves on the back or to make themselves feel good. You know, my van is broke down again. The last time we were here, it was nighttime. It was 8 or 9 o'clock. Her dad was out there helping me get it going. It was broke down again the last time we were here. Why? To make himself feel good? No. Because he cared. Because he had the ability to help somebody, and he did. And that's what many others here today and not here are like. We need to cleanse our hearts and be ready to tabernacle with Jesus or Yeshua. What was Jesus doing with us when he came to earth? I quoted it earlier. Let's go look at it. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. The glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Sekenu. He tabernacled with us. If you remember one thing from today, that's what he was doing. He wanted... What are we doing here? You get down here and there's others, we entice them, we say, hey, let's have some fun, whether they're in the church or not, get down here and spend time as a family. Do things that you can't do when you're back home, because there's no time to do it. That's what we're supposed to be doing now. 2 Corinthians 5:1. Our bodies are a tabernacle. Isn't that strange that, you know, some of the tabernacles are kind of been out in the weather for a while. They're getting kind of weather-worn, and some of them are brand new, fresh, and they're running around, and you say, man, I wish I could have one-tenth that energy. I'd be doing great. But it says for in 1 Corinthians 5:1, for we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. It's interesting that he tells us that our bodies are a tabernacle. In verse 4, for we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that morality might be swallowed up by life. What do you do with your tabernacle? Well, those that have ever read the story about Hanukkah and that, when they had Antiochus, what did he do in Maccabees? He wanted to defile the temple. So he did all kinds of perverted things, but like the ultimate coup d'etat was he took a pig and he sacrificed it on the altar, defiled the altar, and then he brought it in and he sprinkled it on the mercy seat, and you know, he wanted to trash everything. He wanted to completely defile it. What do we do with our tabernacles? It doesn't have to be, there's a lot more ways than pig meat. What we watch, what we consume physically with our eyes, with our ears, where our priorities lie, what we do, all of that is what can defile our tabernacles and make us like whitewashed sepulchres. This isn't for anybody to, you know, say, oh, how great am I, how great. All of us need to be aware that if we're not serious, we're wasting our time. Seriously. Go out and have fun. I tell people, you know, because I never saw people go so nuts over college football when I moved to Tennessee. You know, I mean, we were in Wisconsin, Green Bay Packers. I mean, it didn't interest me, but at least I understood, oh, it's national football and all that. Yeah, they all go nuts on that kind of stuff. But they go nuts on college football. And in the fall, every Saturday, there's some football game somewhere. So I tell them, I say, don't waste your time. Go on home and watch the pigskin god. Put on your robes. Your priest, you know, they all got their choir robes. They're orange and white in Tennessee. They got their hymns, Rocky Top. They pay their offerings, tickets and gates and admission. And, you know, go to the world. You're wasting your time. Now, nobody's got it all figured out. What do we do to actually build a relationship? But see, it's not some magic formula. It's not like we got to do, you can't tell somebody, well, here's step one, here's step two, here's step three. All you got to do is desire it in your heart. No matter where you are in your walk, no matter how blessed you have been, if you were raised in a godly family, or how hard you have got it because maybe the environment you came from wasn't so good. It doesn't matter. If it's in your heart, all you got to do is ask. And he'll reach down where you are. I remember several years ago we went to a concert. And the guy that, it was free. Thompson Bowling Arena, which is tens of thousands of people. The guy puts on a concert there. I can't remember his name, but guess what the admission is? It's free. Oh, if you really can, if you're able, bring some food and there'll be big 55-gallon barrels out front. Donate some food for the homeless and the hungry. and then come in and I'm going to put on the concert. And he talks about it. He was actually in prison for murder. He talked about how God, and he was sentenced, he could have had the death penalty, but they sentenced him to life in prison without parole. He says, my life was like a septic tank. And he went on to describe, and this kind of hit home with me, because I've lifted the lid at least 10, 12 times on septic tanks when there's a problem. Anybody that's ever done that, it's something that you'll never forget. He says, my life was like a septic tank, and God reached down, and he stuck his arm in that tank, and he grabbed the biggest, fattest, juiciest, smelliest piece of flotsam that he could find, and he pulled it out, and it was me. So I say, it doesn't matter where you are. He knows what's in our hearts. It doesn't take some magic formula other than, Daddy, I need your help. Show me who you are. What's he going to do after 1,000 years? Revelation, going to end with this. Revelation 21, verse 3, it says, and I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. If the whole purpose of this whole thing is for him to move his throne down to heaven to live with you, it's important to him. And if it's important to him, it should be important to us. You want a tabernacle with our Father forever? Is your earthly tabernacle longing for the time when Jesus returns, establishes his Father's kingdom, and we live with him for 1,000 years? And then, after some house cleaning is taken care of, and Satan is destroyed, we live with our Father forever. Who doesn't want that? I'm telling you, he wants it with you. We should want it with him. And if we don't, please, coming to me and asking, or anybody else, how do I get it? Yeah, you can ask the questions, but I'm going to tell you the answer now. Get on your knees and ask. Because that's all it takes. And notice, ain't no altar call. But it truly is that simple. Don't do it like me. I gave him 15 minutes, and then I was going to go kill somebody. Show me who you are, and then I'm going to go kill somebody. Good thing that I'm standing here today, and he knocked me down to my knees. Don't make the mistakes that a lot of others before you have made. If you don't have the relationship, the most important thing you can do while you're here is start building it now.